Blog Talk Radio.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, don't concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, don't concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word is
any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussyfooting, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
no return, I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfucker, upmade me out of self-righteous hatred. And now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix. A suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand? They'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, aka Mr. Top Self himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness ever since the Declaration of Independence. We've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years, they're prejudiced. Foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News. I am Solomon. Be joined in a couple moments, by Andrea Zamudio, and also, you know, soon we'll be joined by a couple of our new student correspondents, who are two local college students in the D.C. metropolitan area. We'll be talking about education and a range of things. We're trying to hit the ground running because we've got a power-packed show today. Today, at about half past. The hour, whatever hour you're listening to this show, whether you're listening to it live or on archive, about half past, so about 25 minutes, 26, 24 minutes, we will be having a featured guest with Brother Diop Olubalu, who is a mayoral candidate in the city of so-called brotherly love, so-called brotherly love, and that's none other than Philadelphia, PA. He's running for mayor in that city, and has got a very progressive platform, to say the least. So we're going to be talking about him, why he decided to run, what his platform is, most importantly, and how that, you know, separates himself in terms of ideology from the incumbent, Michael Nutter, who has shown himself to be a very corporate-centered candidate. I mean, not candidate, but mayor, nonetheless, and has embraced everything from charter schools to, a police state in the city of Philadelphia. And obviously, Philadelphia has some issues, you know, regarding, crime in that issue. I mean, and it's a crime within that city. But as we know, there are many, many different intersectionalities that create crime in any city, such as, a city that is starved of economic resources, regardless of where that place is, you're going to see escalated crime. But it's, Diop is going to talk about, Michael Nutter's policies and his policies, Diop's policies, and how they contrast drastically to that of Michael Nutter. So it's going to be a good show. It's going to be a very good show today. And as usual, what makes our shows is the guest, as well as the call-in guest, you, the listener. So if anyone decides they want to call in during our show, before or after our interview with Diop, you please do. It's 347-945-5191. Once again, that's 347-945-5191. You make the show. Our guests make the show. We're just simply here to facilitate dialogue, conversation, provide critical analysis and news that the mainstream corporate media simply is not going to allow. And so, anyways, without further ado, I'm going to welcome Andrea Zamudio on the show. And soon thereafter, I would say within about a minute or two, about 2 minutes, we're going to have two young men who are college students. Both under the age of 21, you know, probably about 19, 20 years of age, and they're going to be serving as correspondents, and they're going to be reporting on some critical analysis that they have examined regarding public education in America. So, Andrea, real quickly, I just want to welcome you on the show because I can see one of our callers is on the line. Andrea, you have any opening comments before we get this ship on the off the dock?
Yeah, it's good to be with you. I'm just looking forward to having Brother Diop on the show. I don't think that independent party candidates really ever get the platform that they deserve, and so I hope that we can share with our listeners a different perspective.
Right, definitely. Looking forward to seeing mayoral candidate Diop Olubalu on our show today. So without further ado, I want to welcome on one of our student correspondents. Are you on the air? I'm not sure which one of this is Zane or if this is Maurice. Are you on?
Yeah, this is Maurice.
How you doing, Maurice? Welcome to Your World News. We're doing fine. So you're on with Andrea and Solomon, and I prepped our listeners about who you are, in a very thin thumbnail sketch, that you were college students. If you could just briefly tell us, who you are, and then we'll get to your analysis of education.
Okay. Well, my name is Murray Silva, as briefly stated earlier, and I'm a student here at University of Maryland. I grew up in Maryland itself, Montgomery County, if any of the listeners are familiar with that area. And currently I'm a mechanical engineer, big on math and science and, like, technology, inventing things, but I see myself as an activist too, because I like to make change and promote positive thinking and things like that. Yeah, that's all basically right, who I am.
All right, thank you. And real quickly, we have Zane Adam on the show. Zane, can you briefly tell our listeners, you know, who you are? Just give us a thumbnail sketch of yourself.
Okay. My name is Zane Adam. Everybody, I am a junior. I'm 19 years old, and I'm a communications major. And I hope to go to graduate school for education and policy procedure. So I guess I have like a little bit of interest in the school systems in America. And like, I also like to see like it from a different perspective in how it's the major flaws affect minorities and other groups as well.
Right. And welcome. I just wanted to, you know, the conversations that we've had off air, you know, we've also talked about the corporate media and its lack of providing, you know, myriad perspectives in terms of everything from educational policy, thing from institutional racism, police brutality. Those things are quite often, prison industrial complex, right, military industrial complex, are quite often purposely and methodically left off of the mainstream airways, whether they may be radio or television. So you both of you young men understand the need and the importance of independent media and for many more of us like yourself to really take the mantle and to continue to get the information out there to the masses, to your colleagues, your peers as students and moving forward. And so we welcome you on, and I'm glad, very happy to have you as your world news correspondent, not just this show, but for many shows to come forward. So I want to start off asking you a question. So what you've done, both of you, and you know, this question is to both of you, whichever one wants to field it first, that's fine. I want to ask you, what have you, because you guys were working independently as well as in a tandem, what things have you, did you examine regarding education, and what are some of the things that, I guess, really kind of cause you a great deal of concern regarding education in America?
Well, this is Marie speaking, and what I see is that the education system here in America, like, works in favor of one party over the other, and it seems like the party that it works against is minorities, and by minorities, I mean African-Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, like, things like primarily black schools and minority schools are places where, like, inner cities, any city places where it's mostly minorities, like there's a lack of educational resources and qualified teachers. And I know Zane did some research about just the way the money is spent on education in the U.S. You want to talk about that, Zane?
Right, yeah. Okay, so I was on whitehouse.gov yesterday, which is like, it's public, it's open to the public. And so the percentage allotted to this is a blatant discrepancy in our priorities here in America. And the percentage allotted to all national defense is 34.38%. That's over one third of the entire monetary budget to maintain our great democracy here in the U.S. and our self-appointed mission of manifest destiny throughout the world. Now, as for that right here at home, where there are malnourished, undereducated, and immobile members within our society, and by that I guess we can pinpoint minorities, the percentage for low-income school districts from K through 12 is less than 1%. It's 0.43%. Now, I think that shows where our priorities are. With respect to the low-income school districts, that's 1% in relative to the national defense. That is very that causes great concern for me. If these inner city like school kids, you know, are being underfunded, under-resourced with respect to textbooks and teachers, like Marie said, then within that information that is being taught, can we also look into what is the information that's actually being taught? And so within that, I think that our societal curriculum is very one-dimensional, with respect to Eurocentrism, like Eurocentric values, and also like the propagation of how America and democracy and all that is working. And
if you, is of everyone that's not associated with shady.
Okay, so and everyone can pull themselves up by their bootstraps, but that's simply not the case. So, like within that, African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, you know, they're not taught their own history. You know, we come to school to learn America's history. You know, we learn about the white middle class, the founding fathers. As for Native Americans, who were the real founding fathers? You know, as for any Native Americans who are actually in the classroom, you know, we're not taught explicitly about how Manifest Destiny wiped out an entire Native population. You know, that's just one example. And as for the slave trade, we learn about that, but then it's not stressed enough that the slave trade was essentially the backbone of America's economy. You know, they just say that, oh yes, like this happened, okay, on to the next subject. You know, and I think for African Americans who are, you know, I guess now indigenous to this country, is very disturbing for them to, you know, one, their history was taken from them, it was robbed from them, and also it is not even on their own list, like for learning.
Mm-hmm.
They have to learn it outside of the classroom. And if they're not learning it inside of the classroom, if they're not being stimulated inside of the classroom, you know, then I think that serves, that's a very big problem. And they become, and so essentially we have to, within the classroom, within the professional setting, you know, we have to subjugate ourselves, become subservient to the Eurocentric standard of professionalism and content in order to make it in America's economy, capitalist economy. And within that, I would just like to say that we lose our culture. And within that, like, we're losing a big part of who we are. And I think if white students or, you know, students of the upper class were, you know, not taught their history, there would be a big problem for their parents, you know? Like, they would come to school like, hey, what are you teaching these kids? But as for the masses, as for minorities, you know, we're being silenced. I feel that's a very big problem. We're being silenced, and we're taught to just love the other, not love ourselves, you know, and we're not being taught about our own history. So that's a big problem for me. Maurice, you can go into what you would like to say.
To talk about, like, what's going in the schools, really, you're talking about how minorities, they usually stay silent on topics like that. The thing is, educators these days, I mean, from my own experience of what I've seen and what I've experienced, and due to some research too, educators tend to hold low expectations for minority students, and they're usually referred to special ed at a much higher rate than white students would be. And minorities, I mean, of course, I know you know, Zane, from like school in Montgomery County even, which is like it's a pretty rich and wealthy county.
Right.
Minorities outnumber whites in special ed and in-school suspension and all the remedial courses, and they're very underrepresented in honors and AP classes.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I just feel like for minorities, they just have a much longer ladder to climb if they want to make it to the top. Like from my own experience, even though I was born here and spoke English fine, I was put into an ESOL class initially in a grade school. And then I had to work my way out of that ESOL class. And then to get to the high level of math that I took in high school and college, I remember I had to make that push in elementary school. I remember, like, just trying every day, proving to my teacher that I could keep up with those kids. And then she finally let me into the upper level class. And then from there on, like, just started my engineering career, really.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and, oh, yeah. I mean, I just also want to talk about, that's just a great school. Now, talking about colleges, it feels like colleges are so expensive that they only appeal or they literally weed out a certain population of the United States from going to college because of how expensive they are. And that population that's weeded out is mostly minorities too. And just some stats, college tuition and fees rose 439% from 1982 to 2007, when the median family income only rose 147%. So, I mean, I just don't feel like those numbers match. And, yeah, I just see a lot of people struggling to pay for school, and it actually causes people to make a decision not to go to school when they should, because the first time I learned about my real African history and heritage was in college when I took an African history course, and I really liked it, and I was wondering, why didn't I learn that in high school? Why did I learn about Columbus found America in high school when there was people already here? You know, things like that, like you were talking about earlier about the one-dimensional type of teaching.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That was deep, man. And since we're approaching Columbus Day, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's, you know, that's a federal holiday that it glorifies.
Yeah.
And I mean, and to look at, I mean, that's a much more deleterious, you know, version of white supremacy than, you know, some skinhead with a, you know, a swastika etched into his head, because that's the federal, like, you know, propagandizing of a individual who was a mass murderer, rapist, mutilator, and one of the biggest cheerleaders for the African slave trade. And so for that to be forced down the throats of any child, especially those of color, those who are from, you know, indigenous backgrounds, you know, throughout the so-called Americas, and those who are sons and daughters of Africa, it's a slap in the face. It's a complete slap in the face. That's like having, you know, a Hitler Day, and having you know, children who are of the Jewish faith having to study and to be, you know, implicitly, at the very least, implicitly obsequious to Christopher Columbus. And before we get off, I know Andrea has a quick question to ask you guys.
Right.
Andrea?
Yeah, I know you guys mentioned a little bit about the effects that such a one-sided history can have on children of color, but I guess in a larger context, how do you think that this can affect black and brown students from organizing and from, you know, becoming the activists that you guys feel you have become because of the history that you've learned? So how do you think that, do you think that this is by design? Do you think that this is done purposefully to neglect a certain type of movement occurring within these communities?
Right. Maurice, do you want to go?
Okay.
Go ahead. Okay, so I guess I'll start from my perspective. Okay, so a person that really catalyzed my involvement and my, like, I guess my stake in this sort of movement of organizing and collaborating and literally, like, searching education for our own sake was Malcolm X. I read his novel outside of the classroom. He was never taught in school. If anything, he was taught to the students, or not even taught to the students, but brushed by as an extremist. And he's gone today. Martin Luther King, gone today. As for Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, all Garvey, all of those leaders, we're not taught about them in K-12 education. So for the organizers who have already put in their work, and I credit Solomon as well, they're not at the forefront. They're not at the forefront of, like, the lesson plans. So with respect to that, I think those people were the ones who organized and, you know, they sort of set off the fuse to, like, help people, you know, saying get in touch with, I guess, like, things that actually matter in society. So when all these leaders, and also the Black Panthers, many of them were either assassinated or put in jail. Like, let's call, like, the minority population a spear. And these leaders were, you know, the head of the spear. You know, they were the ones at the forefront, the generals. And they were taken out of the picture. All of a sudden, that spear that was very powerful, you know, in moving society, in moving, like, populations, has become a peaceful staff. You know, we've become passive. So I think it is systemized, you know, with regards to who actually shot Malcolm X, who designed that, who shot Martin Luther King. these leaders were taken right off the map. And so for people like us, you know, trying to find our own, you know, like we're trying to pick up where these people left off. But at the end of the day, it's very hard because these people are gone. And as for the examples, we have to look harder. We have to look outside of the classroom, wherein it should be inside the classroom. We have to look outside of our own friend circles who are not interested in these things. So we're very, you know what I'm saying, we're lost children, I feel like, because like our forefathers, our founding fathers, have been taken away from us. That's personally how I feel. Maurice, you can speak on that.
Yeah, I feel you on that, especially on how, like, leaders were taken away. And even if there were new leaders to rise now, they would be looked at as a threat by, I mean, most of the country. They'd be like, oh, they're radical, they're trying to make a change that, like, we don't want. And it's kind of hard with to get followers as a leader because of all the distractions there are these days.
Right.
Like, if just all the advertisements you see every day, like, just cars, the music that people be listening to on the radio. I personally don't watch TV or listen to the radio, but whenever I do have a glance, then they're always trying to sell something or move people away from, like, what they really want, what would really be good for them, you know what I'm
right.
saying? And then again, there's those people who are scared to make a change. They're scared of what their public image, of what people would think of them, of not being accepted. Like in the case of the University of Maryland with the workers, like if one of the workers speak up and try to make a change, like that some of them are scared that they might lose their job because someone with authority might, you know, they'll just, even though they might not lose,
right.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying. I just feel like with all the distractions in the way that people view, like, let's say, like, black leaders, just it makes it hard for that to happen. And it is systematic, if to answer Andrea's question, but not directly, like, through things like the media and just the feel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. That was right on point. I mean, that was, and I'm not just saying this because, you know, you're guessing the show. It's just that was a critical analysis. The last 20 minutes that you guys broke down in terms of education that, quite frankly, I more times than not, I cannot count on, you know, adults my own age or even older to break down and to deconstruct. And that's a lot of that is because the longer you're in the system without realizing that you are in the system and what the system
sure.
is, you become entrenched in it and you become a part of the system. And so it's you guys have been woken up very early in the game. You know, you guys, you know, hopefully have another 70, 80, 90, you know, plus years on this earth. And so it's very early on the game, and your understanding, you're able to see what the system is before it actually continues to weave its tentacles around, you know, your minds. And so
absolutely.
What I want to say is, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg. If you guys could agree to come on Your World News, you know, twice a month, we would love to extend our dialogues, you know, to, you know, a half hour, you know, or longer. And I think I would love to have you guys, the next show, have you guys continue where you left off on education, because, as you know, we're just tipping the iceberg in
right.
terms of deconstructing education in America. So, you know, would you be open to that?
Yeah,
of course.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Definitely. And let your peers know that this is a good place for them to cut their teeth activist wise by getting involved and being, you know, street journalists, if you will, street journalists who are reporting on the real issues from a perspective that is methodically marginalized. So I just want to thank you guys for coming on, because we have our next guest coming on, Diop Olubalo, who is a candidate for mayor, that the corporate media, once again, is not going to feature this kind of candidate who has a real program. So if you guys can definitely continue to listen to the show when you get off air, Diop is going to be breaking down some things regarding education and in the city of Philadelphia and why he's running for mayor in that city. So thanks for coming on. I appreciate it, young brother.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you
for having us. Okay.
All right. So Andre, it was great to hear, you know, two young men, you know, coming on the show, especially, you know, 19 and 20 years of age, you know, respectfully, to break down, you know, education in that kind of manner. And without further ado, I see that we have just actually briefly lost Diop, but hopefully he'll call back on. I see that we lost him momentarily from the switchboard. So I don't know if it's a technical issue on their end or our end, but hopefully Diop will be calling back in. And while he's calling in, you know, folks, this brother Diop Olabala is a candidate for mayor in the city of Philadelphia. He is a longtime activist, has been an activist since a very, very young age, you know, hailing from Brooklyn, New York, but has also lived in the state of Texas and has been even, you know, he's in his early 30s, has also, you know, served as a union organizer and observed some interesting things about the effectiveness or lack thereof of the union that he was, he was recruited to serve as an organizer. And so now he's in the city of Philadelphia in the state of Pennsylvania, and has been for several years, and has observed a lot of the different dynamics within the city of Philadelphia. Michael Nutter, as we discussed before, is a corporate candidate, as we see more and more African-American candidates and incumbent mayors across the country serving the interests of the ruling class, serving the interests of, you know, rich, you know, white, you know, corporate elites. Diop is the opposite of that. Diop is the opposite of that and has been targeted because of his number one, serving the people first, serving people who have been marginalized for not just years but decades in Philadelphia. But I mean, as I said before, his activism spans, you know, across the globe. And so this conversation, we're pleased to welcome Diop and to hear more about who he is, and most importantly, hear about his platform. Because as I said before, the corporate media is not going to tell you about Diop and candidates like him. Tell you about their platforms, because their platforms make too much damn sense, and that's why they're not supposed to be heard or seen or anything like that by the masses. They're not supposed to have the option of choosing a candidate like Diop. And so we're playing our part to have him on here, and hopefully this show, and when it's archived, continues to reach as many brothers and sisters of all different, you know, backgrounds in the city of Philadelphia, so they can understand that this is the candidate that is most likely in the best interest of them and their families. Diop, you're on with Solomon and Andrea Zamudio on Your World News. Welcome, brother. Uhuru.
How you doing, brother Solomon? It's good to hear your voice, my brother. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. It's been definitely been a while. Too long. So I just wanted to get the show going by asking you if you can let our audience know, like, who you are. How did you come to cut your teeth as an activist, and what brought you to this stage of your life where you are right now, where you've pretty much committed your life to the people in the struggle, of the masses of historically oppressed people, not just in this country but worldwide?
Yeah. Well, again, Brother Solomon, I really want to thank you for having me on the show. I do want to give you somewhat of a disclaimer, because I'm in the lobby of a church in downtown Philly, which is tonight serving as the venue for a meeting that was called by numerous community activists here in Philadelphia to build the event, or mobilization, that is to be known as Occupy Philly, or Occupy Philadelphia, which is to be a response or an act of quote-unquote solidarity with the action that is transpiring in New York called Occupy Wall Street. So I am actually in the lobby of that meeting and trying to participate in that meeting in as good of a way as possible to raise up critical issues that are significant to the historically oppressed African community. So I just wanted to let you know that, and I may have to leave this interview before we originally intended for it to last, only because of the importance of my intervention in this particular meeting. But to answer your question, you know, I began as a community activist in college, actually. I was in the University of Texas at Austin. I was admitted through a so-called affirmative action program called Student Success. And in that process, in the first year that I was admitted into the school through that program, there was a controversial lawsuit that was filed by some white law students at that same university that, you know, caused affirmative action reverse discrimination. And they actually won their case, and that was the beginning or the end of affirmative action in the state of Texas as far as the University of Texas system is concerned. But the point is that that was actually the first time in which I actually engaged in political activism. Prior to that, you know, just like any other black male growing up in American society, we have a lifetime of experiences that impact on our consciousness and help us understand what our relationship to this social system is. And I was no different as a young brother. You know, I lived that life that taught me many lessons. But it wasn't until actually becoming a college student that I was actually introduced to activism and participating in political life in any form. And also, I do want to give some credit and recognition to hip-hop music, rap music that, you know, I grew up on, and many, you know, my generation. I grew up in the 80s, and, you know, I grew up to the soundtrack of Public Enemy, Ice Cube, you know, N.W.A., Eric B. and Rakim, et cetera. And as you probably remember, that was a period where political consciousness was, you know, being promoted through the music, and that definitely helped shape my consciousness. But all that basically helped to develop, you know, who I am today. And I definitely want to just say that, you know, my joining the Uhuru movement in the year 2001 really transformed my life and brought me from an activist to a revolutionary.
Right. And I would have to say the same thing about hip hop, man. I can't say it, emphasize it any more than what you already have. I mean, without hip hop, that's what really radicalized and politicized me in so many ways. My next question, I wanted to ask you, Diop, if you could talk about your platform for mayor and how it because I've looked at your platform. I've read about it online. You know, I've gone to Uhuru News and read about it. What is your platform about, and how does it drastically contrast from that of Michael Nutter?
Well, you know, they're like night and day. My program, my platform, calling for economic development for particularly for the historically oppressed African and Latino communities, as opposed to Michael Nutter's program, which is essentially a public policy of police containment, where literally billions of dollars are spent every year on the building of prisons, the funding of courts and police that occupy our community. And all of this occurs at the expense of our communities, which suffer not from crime and violence amongst ourselves, but from the violence and crime being inflicted on our communities by the city of Philadelphia and Michael Nutter's policies. So everything that you hear me talk about in my campaign and subsequent to it will revolve around fundamental demand for economic development, the usage of the billions of dollars towards jobs, businesses that promote the needs of the community and provide people with a way to eat, as opposed to fighting each other over crumbs, which is essentially what the behavior that the government characterizes as criminal or violent behavior. So that's my platform, and it's, you know, the antithesis, as they say, of that which Michael Nutter is propagating.
Brother Diop, I wanted to ask you a question regarding an article that you wrote in Euronews talking about the state of Philadelphia's education system. You discussed that 2.1 million or 30% of the funding for vocational training has been cut. You know, some people would argue that charter schools provide students with preparation for specific jobs after graduation as well. But can you deconstruct the differences between vocational training programs and charter schools run by private corporations such as Walmart and the emphasis they place on standardized testing and test-taking?
Yeah, definitely. That's a very good question because, first of all, even while charter schools and the corporations that fund them claim that the schools are preparing our students and our youth for the labor market, the reality is that most of the resources that the charter schools are dedicated to revolve around training students to take standardized tests well. And actually, the student's ability to perform well in the standardized tests is the litmus test or the standard by which the government and even private entities determine how much money those charter schools and the school district itself will receive. So essentially, we see more or less of a incestuous type of relationship occurring between the school district and or the government and the private corporations which are funding the charter schools. But nowhere in that equation, in that relationship, is the question of genuine economic development being addressed. And economic development, I mean jobs, businesses that promote the needs of the students and the communities they come from. And at the same time, while the charter schools are receiving more attention, more funding, the obvious choice or programs that would stimulate interest in training and develop skills in critical areas of economic development would be the vocational programs. You know, in the labor, and I'm gonna tell you something. In Philadelphia right now, a recent study was done in which it was revealed that the average black man that is unemployed today between the ages of 30 and 50 will never work again in his life, right? And at the same time, we have a city that pays out billions of dollars in contracts to build up institutions, hospitals, civic centers, et cetera. And all of those contracts are, you know, paid out to corporations, contracting firms that don't even employ residents of Philadelphia, i.e., you know, black workers, Latino workers. And to me, all of this points to the fact that the students of the Philadelphia school system are not only being locked out of the labor market once they graduate, but they're not even being provided with the skills and training to participate in the labor market should the possibility of a job or getting a job exist. And my proposal, my program, I'm calling for an education system that plays a central role in the process of economic development, where the schools themselves are transformed into a university to train students around basic skills that they can use and apply towards businesses and development of the community. For example, I just held a town hall meeting a couple of weeks ago introducing my program to feed the city of Philadelphia through an urban agricultural program. This urban agricultural program would transform the city's 40,000 empty or vacant lots into community gardens that would produce fruits and vegetables that could feed the starving masses of the people. And those community gardens would be staffed and ran by the students of the Philadelphia School District. This is just one small example of the possibilities that exist within the school district. Turn it into an institution that really trains the students to become not just workers to work for IBM or Walmart, but to work for the people. And in fact, to build up businesses that make it unnecessary to go shopping at Super Walmart in the first place, because you can go to your community garden down the street. So, you know, these are the possibilities that do exist. The money is there, but we have to fight for new leadership to open up these possibilities, and that's what I represent.
Absolutely. And not to mention how, you know, providing individuals with a proper education and an opportunity to get a job would reduce the crime rate. I know that's something that you've argued as well, versus, you know, ramping up police in a police state, you know, giving people jobs and education is the real solution to reducing the crime rate.
Yes, yes. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I'm sorry, did you have another question?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about your plan to develop a community-controlled board of education, and so I just wanted to ask you, how exactly would you go about implementing such a board, and how do you feel it would better serve the community in comparison to a traditional board of education?
Yeah, well, right now, the in Philadelphia in particular, but this is not peculiar to Philly, but in Philly, the school district is essentially ran by its superintendent and a board known as the School Reform Commission, which every member of which is appointed by the mayor of the city. Currently, the School Reform Commission in Philadelphia is nothing but a gang of thieves and hustlers who have actually stolen the people's resources, used the millions of dollars that have been afforded to the school budget to fill their own pockets, including such incidents as giving themselves $1,000 per day per diem stipends. In fact, the superintendent of the school district, or former superintendent Arlene Ackerman, recently resigned. She would say she was forced out, but either way, she left. She abandoned her post, and not before she took away $1 million severance package. This is the people's money. And meanwhile, there's a claim that there's not enough resources for the school, and that is true because the governor of Pennsylvania has cut the budget for the Philadelphia School District, but we can't deny the fact that the School Reform Commission and the superintendent have participated in robbing the schools of the due money that they are entitled to. And my alternative is a community-controlled board of education with power to hire and fire faculty, staff, and administration, the power to shape and define the curriculum so that it meets the needs of the community. The urban agricultural program that I spoke of is an example of the type of curriculum that our community-controlled board of education would put forth. And this is, again, it's not anything new. In fact, it's a very rich history of struggle from particularly black community in Philadelphia and cities like New York, the Ocean Hill-Brownsville struggle of 1968 and 69, where the people organized to establish their own board of education that served the needs of the people. And it took over 30 years for that board of education to be dismantled by Mayor Bloomberg, who now controls the school district. And he obviously is using it as a tool to make profit for the ruling class, and that's what's happening in Philadelphia as well. But I believe in that struggle, and my campaign for mayor is the word escapes me, but it's vindication for that historic struggle for community control of education throughout this country.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about your plan to have the board distribute bonds to those in the community that would like to invest in the system, the education system, and would you allow corporations to buy bonds, or would this just be individual citizens that could buy it?
Well, I think that if corporations were allowed to buy bonds, there have to be very strict parameters and regulations that would define that relationship. But in principle, I'm against that. Only because I know what the interests of the corporations would be in investing in such bonds. And I think that community control of education means just that, community control, not corporate control, you know. And I'm opposed to corporations having any actual private ownership of the school system. And I think that even that being said, it would be a contradiction in terms to say community control of education but allow for private entities to have some ownership of the school system. So I'm against that.
Right. Thank you.
Diab, I know you got to, you know, you got to run and do some more work for the people. But before you get off air, I want to say that officially, I'd like everyone to know that Your World News is officially endorsing you and your campaign for mayor of Philadelphia. And with that being said, how can our listeners tonight or on archives, because we've got thousands and thousands of listeners, how can they contribute to your campaign and help you in any shape, form, or fashion?
Excellent. Well, we are in need of all types of support, everything from volunteers to hit the streets and hand out literature, to precinct captains who would assume responsibility to organize the voters in the area to vote for Diop on November 8th. And when I say Diop, I want to be clear, Wali Rahman is the official name that will be on the ballot. which is a whole other struggle that I don't have time to get into right now. But Wali Diab Rahman will be on the ballot. But we also, especially for those who are not in the Philadelphia area, we need financial contributions because we don't have the major corporations behind us. We only have the people. And, in fact, part of my campaign, I'm saying that proof of the honesty and the genuine commitment I have to the people is in the fact that we will not accept any donation of more than $1,000. And one can do so on the website, DIOP2011, that's DIOP2011.com, and there's a PayPal link that you can go to and make a donation right now. So also, if you'd like to call us, you can reach us at 215-459-7551. That's 215-459-7551. I'm also on Facebook at Diop Olugbala. That's D-I-O-P, last name O-L-U-G-B-A-L-A.
All right, thank you so much. And is there an email address that
you can
use?
Yes, you can reach us at info@diop2011.com.
Perfect, perfect. And we'll go ahead and post that information as well. So I just want to thank you, brother, for coming on. And like I said, we endorse your campaign openly and fully and everything that you stand for and stand by. Thank you so much.
I thank you so much, Brother Solomon. We got to wrap, man, like offline, you know, when we get a chance. I know things are busy for both of us, but I have a lot of respect and appreciation for the work that you do preparing those young brothers and sisters, not just to abandon the life of activism and commitment to the people once they graduate, but seeing that as the starting point, you know, to a life of commitment and struggle. So I really appreciate the work you do, Brother Solomon, and in the media as well.
I appreciate it, and I'll be calling you before the weekend's out. That's for sure.
Please do. Please do.
All right. Take care. Uhuru.
Uhuru.
Well, that was Diop, and what a great interview that was. Andre, what are your thoughts, man? I mean, I'm thinking out loud, and I'm even more excited for this young brother's bid for mayor of Philadelphia, and in a more equitable world and in a less, unfortunately we're in this capitalist cesspool, but in a much more equitable world and obviously a much more fair and egalitarian country, which we don't live in, it's a muck with corporate influence. That candidate that we just heard, his platform and his views, Andrea, as you know, would be prominently put out there in the same kind of equal footing and manner as those corporate candidates, the candidates like Michael Nutter, the ones who have major corporations behind them, and will get all the ad time, in the Philadelphia Inquirer and all the other, newspapers and television channels in and around Philadelphia proper. And that gives them a leg up. But, as we've seen, in other places, a strong ground game, a people's ground game, can make all the difference in the world. And that's what it's going to take to combat this corporate, these corporate candidates, because Andrea, the people are the ones, the communities in which Diop represents, they can make the difference in terms of, pushing him over the edge and into the seat of power within the city of Philadelphia, and pushing him into the seat of power means that they'll get more power than they've ever had before from the likes of Michael Nutter, from the likes of Ed Rendell, and on and on. We can go all the way back, man. And so it's really important for those listening that liked what they heard, for them to go online and to find out how they can help out in some shape, form, or fashion, whether it's a donation that is not going to break anyone's bank, that they can give what they can give, or, and if not, what kind of time and effort can they give to Diop's platform? Because, you know, it's those corporate candidates, Andrea, they're not going to see any light. They're not going to stick their damn head. Once the campaign's over, they might be for a little photo op in somewhere in Germantown or in Northwest Philly, you know, in West Philly. They might be there for a little photo op. But once the campaign is over, the only presence that they're going to have in a place like, you know, North Philly, West Philly, is a police presence. They're gonna continue to send, you know, a strong police presence and to continue to impose a police state type of environment in the state of in the city of Philadelphia. What are your thoughts, Andrea, from this interview and Diop's platform?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a beautiful thing to hear someone who could potentially be a politician speaking the way that he's speaking. It, you know how you mentioned in the beginning, what the things that he says and his plans are very common sense, and if people were exposed to something like that, it would be very easy for candidates like himself to win. But that's exactly why the mainstream media, you know, does not allow independent party politicians like himself and people from the Green Party to have the same opportunity as Republicans and Democrats to speak out, because they represent the agenda of the people and something that could actually create systemic change. And to me, it was very motivational and inspirational to hear that, because I think a lot of times, we focus on all these changes that we want to create and how it's just so much, and, you know, individual people might not be able to change a whole system. But I think that what he represents is this idea that you start locally, you know, and you implement these, for example, his plan to have the urban gardening, the centers in Philly, and provide, like, have that be a job for people, and also a way to provide healthy food, locally grown food, to the residents there. And so those little things, like, that makes a huge change for the residents in Philly. And when you can develop and make these, you know, ideas a reality in one particular place, it can spread. And that's the beauty of, like, you know, you act locally, but you think globally. You know, and so to me, it was beautiful to see that, because I think that oftentimes we're overwhelmed by the number of problems that we face, militarism and the prison industrial complex, and it's just, you know, you just feel like you're not going to be able to change capitalism by yourself. But when you see, people like him who could potentially be in a position of power to really create that change and have all these, you know, really actually have the community behind him, it's very empowering.
But without a doubt, and I love his campaign slogan. I mean, and it just spoke. If you just go to Diop 2011, that's DIOP2011.com, DIOP2011.com. You know, his slogan, man, right there when you open that page, unbought, unchained, unbroken. I love it. Unbought, unchained, unbroken. How many Democrats and Republicans can say that? Not many at all. If at all any. The whole basis of the Democrats and the Republicans is that they do take corporate money. You know, so they are bought. I mean, you know, you can even find, you know, some of the more, you know, so-called, you know, liberal or progressive Democrats, and you can find that even they have received some significant, you know, campaign contributions from corporations. You know, it may not be, you know, some of them may not be in the millions, but you'll see that it is in the tens of thousands. And a good place for that is to go to opensecrets.org. Opensecrets.org is a good place to chart some of the campaign contributions that are doled out to these so-called politicians. So-called leaders that they're not, So yeah, that was, like I said, I have no hesitation whatsoever saying that Your World News endorses Diop for his bid for
of Philadelphia, for mayor of Philadelphia, because, you know, if we're, whenever we're able to elect the likes of Diop Oluwabalo, it opens up the door for similar candidates in other cities and municipalities. That's exactly what it does. Every single little victory is another dent in the so-called armor of the king, you know, and so his victory in Philadelphia is a victory for all of us, not just in Philadelphia, but those of us in Baltimore and D.C. and South Central and Detroit, Michigan, where the corporations like Walmart are continue to put their leech like tentacles sucking the lifeblood out of African American youth, you know, who attend schools like Frederick Douglass High, you know, pushing them towards Walmart internships and replacing literature courses with Walmart. I mean, this stuff is well documented. These are things that are going on, folks. We've discussed this stuff with the likes of Danny Weil and all the work that he's done. So, anyways, as we transition to the second phase of the show, I want to have I want to play a little musical interlude, and then we're gonna come back on the other end of the show. We're gonna have a little bit more talk on Troy Davis, because his legacy, they may have taken his body, which they did, the bastards, the scumbags that they are. They murdered him, they lynched him, but his spirit and his fire and his passion lives on in all of us who consider ourselves justice-oriented people. And so if we don't want his legacy to be forgotten, and we don't want his struggle to be in vain, it's important for us to continue working towards just completely eliminating the criminal injustice system as we know it, that made it possible for an innocent man to be executed. So, Andre, have you heard the song by Jesari X? Have you heard the song "I Am Troy Davis"?
I haven't.
Okay, well, this will be a treat for you and anybody else who has not heard this song. I want folks to right now. This is a treat by a young brother who's an independent rapper, independent MC, out of, I believe, Pittsburgh, PA, and has done some good work, man. He's done some good work. But when I heard this song, I knew it was something that we had to play on the show. So here is Jesari X, and the song is "I Am Troy Davis." Listen on.
This is Troy Anthony Davis. I've been sitting on Georgia death row for a crime I did not commit. I will never take another human being's life. And this killer is still out there. My family's in mourning. The victim's family's in mourning. And the truth is still locked in because I didn't get justice.
Does the court system employ racists? Then why are so many black boys in cages? Why shouldn't I be paranoid of hatred? Just look at the curious case of Troy Davis. Let's travel on down to Savannah, in the state of Georgia, just south of Atlanta, where they wave a rebel flag like a bandana. Hunger ancestors in pose for the cameras. A white police officer was shot and killed over an argument he tried to stop and heal. But here's where the plot gets real. The main suspect blamed Troy, went to the cops and squealed. And with no physical evidence of weapon, Troy was arrested for a 187. He said he was an innocent man when he was questioned, but they said he did it. Who needs a damn confession? They just need a witness. They compressed the crime. Tell them what to say or they'll arrest the guy. Then put him on the stand and make him testify. Swear to God to tell the truth and do their best to lie. And they did, so Troy was found guilty. Sent to death row by a scheme so filthy. Even though his innocence is true, we pray they don't reminisce over you, my God.
Almost all of the prosecution's star witnesses have changed their stories. Some saying police pressured them to say Troy Davis did. Darrell Collins is one of the prosecution witnesses who signed a police statement implicating Troy Davis.
And I told them over and over that I didn't see this happen. They put what they wanted to put in that statement.
But the truth always comes to light, and Troy Davis didn't give up the fight. He kept filing the bill until it was revealed. The state of Georgia wants an innocent man killed. That's why who's who want him out.
because it's just too much doubt. And witness after witness came forward and admitted the only reason they did it is because police insisted. So wicked, so vicious. The system's broke, so fix it. 2 decades, no Christmas. Execution dates, four listed. Get organized, show resistance. Go online, sign those petitions. Black Americans know the difference. It's a new day, but the same old lynchings. I am Troy Davis. Families destroyed by cases. Why can't we avoid the matrix? Instead of giving his children toys to play with, he's waiting his execution, hoping the court stays it. And I'm praying and doing. We need action, we need movement. Cause his innocence is true. I pray they don't reminisce over you, for real.
Brenda Forrest was one of the jurors.
All of the witnesses, they were able to, you know, to ID him.
This is how the juror feels now.
If I knew then what I know now, Troy Davis would not be on death row. The verdict would be not guilty.
It's a lot of people believe in the death penalty, but they're still working in Troy's behalf because they believe that Troy is innocent. I believe if all these thousands and thousands of people know that Troy is innocent, you know, God sees that.
I am Troy Davis.
I am Troy Davis.
I am Troy Davis.
I am Troy Davis.
Not long after the four-hour additional torture imposed on Troy Davis by the Supreme Court, and after the final word came down that Troy was dead, I got a phone call from an angry friend. He began by asking, "What is the value in electing or investing support for a leadership that cannot stop even this? What is the value in investing support behind these so-called movements that benefit useless leadership more than the people they claim to be moving for?" And then he said, "Troy was definitely a better man than me." "Word?" I asked. "That's my word," he said. He took a breath to calm himself and went on. First of all, his last words were praise to his supporters and all those gathered around the world. Then he had words of encouragement for the family of the cop he didn't kill. "No way, man. I would have been of no use." That line struck me. "What do you mean, no use?" I asked. "Everyone knows he didn't do it," he went on. "Everyone knows it, and yet they all use him while he dies in convenient fashion." "Convenient fashion? That's deep, my man," I said. "Did you watch the coverage on Democracy Now! Last night?" he asked. "Every minute," I said. "Then you know what I mean. The cop's family got polite support from a man from whom they gained closure. The activists got praise from a man they were too soft to save. And Amy Goodman's people got love for doing what they should have been doing for at least 10 years. "I thought they did an okay job," I responded. He laughed a little. "You notice how it is on the night Troy is killed that they gave more attention to his case than during the entire 20 years of his incarceration? And how often do they talk about the associated issues of mass black imprisonment?" "Okay," I said. But he went on, increasingly angered. "What you saw was spectacle. Amy Goodman used his death like CNN used Desert Storm. You heard her say, 'And we are the only ones here covering the moment.' Just like CNN, she was locking up 10 more years of support from the left as the major media." "She didn't do some good with the coverage?" I asked. "Whatever good she did was useless to Troy and useless to the rest of us. And look what she did the next day. Went right back to her real top stories, Israel and Palestine and mainstream journalist book writers." "But that wouldn't have worked with me," he continued, "because I would have used my last words to tell them to go home, to go back to the stories you prefer. I don't want to become a fundraiser for you. You didn't tell my story enough or in ways to get your audience to get me out. I'm about to die anyway, so to me, you are useless. In fact," he said with even more venom in his voice, "I would have told everyone gathered out front, everyone listening to whatever media was covering me, that they should go become a problem, the kind of problem that keeps me alive or gets me out. Make them stormtrooper cops need that gear they brought to the rally. Tell them I won't be the only one to transition tonight. But don't use me to add to your phony activist credentials. If those T-shirts you have on mean something and we indeed are all Troy Davis, then we all should be prepared to die tonight. He noticed my silent discomfort. He sensed my fear of my own politics. But he was angry and relentless. My last words would have been to spread out, break those ranks, and let Sharpton, Brock, and Jealous know no more showtime for you and the God you keep praising is all capable when he can't keep me from the poison. Your God is useless. We don't praise the same one if we praise one at all. My God wouldn't let me and mine suffer while others use that suffering to enrich and reposition themselves. I feel you, I said, and it was even more infuriating to listen to them apologize for Obama's inability to enter. I could not even finish the sentence. Obama's uselessness was so evident and emblematic, he interrupted. His supporters want to let him off the hook, but Davis's case had federal precedent, and he could have applied the 8th or 14th Amendments to halt the execution. A black president, a black attorney general, a black Supreme Court justice, two black men on the Georgia parole board, all the black civil rights glitterati, and still nothing could be done. It is final proof, if we still needed it, of the uselessness of what is called leadership. I agree, but only wish I had the courage to say it myself. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Jared Ball. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
So, yeah. You know, Troy Davis, it's you know, he was lynched on the 21st of September 2011, and here we are. Here we are, the 30th day of the 30th day of September, and our work has to go on. Our work has to go on, all of us. I mean, including myself, including Andrea, including Your World News. We have to be that much more effective. We have to work that much harder. You know, we have to make those little sacrifices because, you know, if it was any of us behind bars facing our impending execution, especially for, you know, a crime that we did not commit, we would want those on the outside to continue to fight hard, long and hard, you know, for us, you know, for justice in general. Justice in general, you know, some of us, if your thing is working on, you know, economic justice, then work harder, you know what I'm saying? Be consistent, you know, at the very least be consistent. Without consistency, you know, we can't expect victories. We have to be consistent, you know. So if you're doing it, you know, three or four times a week, you know, putting in, you know, hours on those days, then you got to do it, make sure that even if it's a different three or four times each week, we have to remain consistent. You know, because our victories over injustices here and there, even if it's not, you know, necessarily the death penalty that we're working on, those injustices, we can't look at these different, you know, struggles against injustice as being mutually exclusive. We just can't, you know, because if we have, you know, more justice in this area and that area, and it starts to catch fire here, then It's gonna find its way, you know, towards the criminal injustice system, you know, more popularly known as the criminal justice system. It's gonna find its way there, and so we have to fight on. Just, you know, we can't just fold up and give up. And I know it's easy to become pessimistic living in this society where there's so many obsequious people that, you know, just kind of tune in every day in and day out to reality shows to escape the reality of their own lives. But, you know, we got to wake up as many as possible. We got to wake up ourselves and stay awake and stay awake until, you know, it's time for us to figuratively, you know, rest and sleep, you know. So, I'll be the first one to say I am not beyond reproach in that, you know. These are challenges that I have to see in myself each day, you know, challenges to become a better activist, to become, you know, more consistent in the work that I'm doing, you know, beyond, not just with Your World News, but beyond Your World News. As you know, we're activists first. Andre and I are activists first, you know, journalists second, you know what I'm saying? And we were trained in journalism in the street, in the school, in the streets of radical journalism, not in, you know, the colleges, universities where they love to try to, you know, change and configure what, you know, what
kind of news, so-called news and information you follow, you cover, you know, taking your orders from some, you know, either some handkerchief head Negro or some, you know, white liberal or conservative that's serving as the editor in chief at a newspaper or executive editor at a television show or a television station or a radio station that will tell you, you know, what to cover or what not to cover and so forth. We take our orders from what's going on in the streets, and we're not going to let the corporate media and mainstream America dictate what issues we cover or don't cover. We don't have time to do that anymore. Our political expression must go much further beyond the ballot box, and it needs to start yesterday. So, Andrea, what's some area that you see yourself, you know, carrying inspiration from Troy Davis and the magnificent work that he did while he was incarcerated for pretty much two decades and where you can improve on the work that you're already doing.
Well, you know, I was always against the death penalty. I don't think that I really was aware enough about the issue, and then when this happened, you know, it really brought to light how severe it is, and I think for a lot of people, especially you know, younger people, it was the last couple of days it was on the news everywhere, and it kind of just caught people's attention. And so for me, I know that when I started becoming more aware of the situation, I made a promise to myself in honor of Troy Davis and all the other people who are on death row like himself that may very well be innocent. A lot of them are innocent. That I would, you know, look into some of these groups who are already doing work and learn more about it, you know, get more educated in terms of the numbers and, the process of how this occurs. And, there's already a lot of great groups doing good work. I think that that's something that a lot of times we underestimate, that, you know, it's just like you're starting from scratch on any given social problem, but that's not really the case. It's a matter of more like, you know, learning what groups are really about creating radical change versus groups that are, just trying to reform a system that is working the way it was designed to work. And so, I think my personal goal is to, you know, is to look into these organizations and see how I can contribute. There's a lot of things to fight for, but I think that it's just that's something that, you know, we're in the 21st century. The U.S. is the only so-called developed country that still has the death penalty, and I think that it's another profit-making industry and another form of institutional racism that, you know, should be obliterated. And so I hope that I don't hope I will educate myself, but I do hope that I've been talking to some people around my age and younger about it, and I hope that it's not one of these, you know, trends that, like, you know, I'm gonna post it on my Facebook or I'm gonna tweet about it because it's what's happening and it's messed up, and then kind of just, you know, go about their lives, kind of how Jared was describing, you know, in terms of Democracy Now's coverage of, it was like this huge ordeal the night of, but then later on, it kind of died down. And yeah, they brought it up a couple times within the last couple shows the last week, but like he was saying, that his friend was saying, it's, why wasn't it being covered like that for the last 20 years? You know, there's no, it's not going to have the same effect when, you know, you want to cover it last, you know, that day, and then, you know, and it was like a spectacle. Like, it's, you know, that's not, to me, when I was watching the whole thing and how it was being covered, it almost seemed like this game, you know, and it was kind of like disgusting and sickening that we're just like sitting here and like just watching, like, instead of, like, you know, what it made me reflect in terms of, like, what should I have been doing before it got to this point, because it just felt wrong. I don't know if I'm like articulating it correctly, but it just, to me, it felt wrong that it was almost like you're pimping like the situation of someone possibly dying. You know what I mean? Like, and I just don't think that it makes sense within a capitalist system for certain people to do that, but I think that for those of us who would like to think that we want to create real change and that's what we aspire to, it would make us feel uncomfortable and would, you know, motivate us to reflect on what more we can do to really not allow things to get to that point and not have someone's life be this, you know, this whole spectacle where people are just watching and sitting back and waiting instead of like having had done something.
Right, and exactly. I mean, and you're right. I mean, that's, you know, you don't just, you know, and I'll say it, man. I mean, as a proud African man, I'm just saying, listen, you know, folks of color listening, and you know, if you're, you know, radical progressive like white folks listening, you're not gonna, you know, not gonna take what I'm saying as a shot against you, but you know, people of color, like, yo, we need, and Andre, you heard me say this, you know, a million times, you know, we cannot continue to take our marching orders from white liberals in any shape, form, or fashion, and that's exactly what Amy Goodman is. She's a white liberal, you know, and you know, with the whole Libya coverage or lack thereof, we can see that. I mean, during this whole onslaught with Libya, we see the role or the lack thereof that Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! is playing. I mean, there was no balance whatsoever. That's fine if your show is based on you're trying to, you know, cover news and information that's not out in the corporate media, and you're trying to also provide like balance and critical analysis, then do that. You know, but when you just have a cavalcade, you know, and a procession of voices of people who are in support of the U.S.-backed and NATO-backed mass bombing and war on Libya, its people, and its infrastructure, without having any kind of counter voices or folks that can come out and that will come on there and give a different perspective, I mean, then to hell with you, because this is real. This is life or death. You know what I'm saying? You're talking about people getting executed. We're talking about, listen, we have to start looking at these things in different manners. I mean, we get amped up about executions and unjust, you know, as we did with Troy Davis, and rightfully so. But in the same token, we need to get amped up about executions that are occurring by way of imperialist, you know, bombs and imperialist backed, you know, rebels who are seeking out, you know, black Libyans and black Africans who are working and who have been working in Libya, living in Libya, seeking them out like they were the Ku Klux Klan, seeking them out and lynching them. This is stuff that's been happening on the ground in Libya for months now. And the corporate media ignores it, yeah, and doesn't cover it. But you would think that, hey, you know, this so-called, you know, progressive, you know, show called Democracy Now! Is going to cover. They've been exposed. Their coverage, the lack thereof in Libya, has been exposed, all right? Because this is an imperialist back war that with these greedy European and U.S., you know, oligarchs and you know, thieves and thugs have their eyes set on Libya's natural resources, mainly oil, and yes, that huge man-made aquifer as well. That's what they have their sights set on. You know, they have their sights set on. You think all of a sudden overnight, you know, people, these folks have an issue with Gaddafi? When Obama, you know what I'm saying, you know, just before, you know, several months before this happened, was shaking his hand, and Hillary Clinton was meeting with his son in Washington. You think all of a sudden they you know they just saw have some kind of problem and that, with leadership there? No, it has nothing. No way. Any more than Obama and the U.S. had a problem with Mubarak, who was a real dictator. Yeah, Mubarak was an authentic, real dictator. Massacring, and torturing, Egyptian civilians and whoever the U.S. decided to rendition into Egypt for a long time. U.S. was financing his coffers at the tune of $3 billion a year. And all of a sudden, the U.S. has a problem with it? No, it's because they're trying to do the popular thing and then try to, because they know that they're soon to be, as the people, in places like Egypt, we're staging a real people's revolution, not this bullshit that we see here in Libya. It's not a people's revolution. That's a bunch of thugs, dressed up and calling themselves Libya. And the U.S. media, deliberately showing, and limiting images that they want, so that it continues to shape public, the public image and the public consent around this issue. Amy Goodman and the like, if they're not going to hell with them, to hell with them. And I said it here. I said it. This is what separates, programs like ours, Black Agenda Report and the work they do. This quest to end these wars of imperialism, to end injustice within the U.S. borders, as well as the injustices that are caused by U.S. imperialism and wars of aggression. We got to be consistent about our work and get it front and center out there. And that includes everyone listening right now. You have a choice whether to keep your mouth shut or to go to your friends and your families and your coworkers and to start these dialogues and to give them the information that they're simply not getting, but they should get about Libya. So I implore anyone to go to Black Agenda Report or go to yourworldnews.org. Go to yourworldnews.org. Click on blogs. And there are some radio interviews that were done on WBAI, as well as some interviews that were done by Cynthia McKinney talking about Libya that you can find there. Just click on the link, and that's that alternative information that you need to listen to. So, those other folks that have exposed themselves, to hell with you. To hell with you. Because, people's lives, and this is not some kind of popularity contest that saying, oh, we're the first to, we were there outside, waiting for the execution of Troy Davis. We were out there, we're the only ones out there. As Jared's friend said, you should have been doing that work for years. But even if such, even if you weren't doing that work for years, it was just kind of very airy. As you indicated, Andre, watching that coverage, and I was in a place where it was on. We were waiting to show a movie, and that was on the TV screen. But it was just kind of airy. Yes, waiting, praying, for this brother not to be murdered. But it was just kind of airy, and it just felt kind of strange. I don't even know how to describe it beyond that, but it was just kind of strange. But my point is, like, executions is as Dr. King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So if we're against executions in the U.S., then we should be against the executions that come by way of missiles and missiles being dropped by way of manless drones in Pakistan and Afghanistan, in Libya, in Yemen, in Somalia. We should be against U.S.-backed, our tax dollars financing U.S.-backed death squads. Otherwise, you want to popularly call them rebels, going into villages and massacring you know, black Africans because of their allegiance with Gaddafi, because of the stance that he took in terms of recognizing, you know, black Africans and apologizing for the Arab slave trade. And any Latino, and as you told us, Andre, any Latino who is from Central America that is now here, that is listening to this show right now, and I think, Andre, you know where I'm going with this, that is listening to this show right now, and you are against and you rail against the U.S. for its role in financing death squads in places like El Salvador, all right, and throughout Central America, and having Honduras serve as launching pad for these death squads, you know, otherwise known as Contras, you know, to go into village and to knock and knock off, you know, any, you know, say Nicaraguan who is in support of a socialist movement, is in support of the likes of Sandinistas and so forth, then, you should be against, and you should be outspoken, and you should be in the streets and telling your colleagues and telling your families that this right now is what's going on in Libya is not much different, because if you're against those death squads in Central America, you should be against those death squads in Libya. Those death squads, otherwise known as rebels, because the Contras were dressed up the same damn way. I was a young enough kid to remember, were dressed up in the same way in American media propaganda, as if they were some kind of force that was, you know, fighting the evil of communism that was, you know, could be encroaching upon America, but is doing so much bad in Central America, the evil communism. Andrea, is that a valid point for people to be more consistent and to look at these death squads, I mean, to look at the rebels as death squads the same way we looked at the Contras as death squads? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're against, you know, your country being occupied and, you know, innocent people being murdered because they're defiant to a system that only, enriches a minority of the country, and the imposition of corporations privatizing everything from water to the production of all types of crops in your country. You know, you have to see it as a problem that, you know, it is occurring not only in where you're from, but it's something larger that's just a product of U.S. imperialism, and that's occurring across the world. And when you see that, we should be just as angered if it's happening, you know, wherever we're from, as if it's happening to somebody else, because there's really no difference, you know?
Right. Yep, you're exactly right. And speaking of that, you know, to kind of shift the tide, I want to play this clip, Andrea, that you may or may not heard of Brother Glenn Ford breaking down some stuff. Because, and I bring this up because of, the recent, and you know what? You know, these frauds, Andrea, man, these frauds, who am I talking about? These frauds, called the CBC. We just had the CBC week last week, yeah, where Congressional Black Caucus members, and a bunch of folks in D.C. got together, you know, and want to throw a whole bunch of parties. I mean, you have this collection of black people there and black elected officials, and there's no mass. I mean, Andrea, there could have been a mass, you know, town hall rally, you know, for the people. They get together, to talk about mass incarceration in America and how it is affecting black people in America, talking about, how Troy Davis's, wrongful death and legal lynching is an example of the mass incarceration and prison industrial complex in this country. and the unequal justice justice system that is in this country that is very much broken down racial lines. You know, that could have been an opportunity, Andrea, but we know that, you know, those of us that live in D.C., we see the parties, oh, CBC party here, this is so-and-so is going to be here, and all these obsequious, you know, little house Negroes, going out there and at whatever cost supporting Obama, political pundits, that are more concerned, Andrea, they're more concerned with extending their contract to come on programs like, stations like CNN and MSNBC. You know, they don't want to rock the boat too much, all right, because they know if they go too far out, they're not going to be invited back on those shows. So I'll just say so much. And then, you know, with Obama, I'm not gonna press him. I'm just going to say so much. You know, and this dude bitch slapped him this past week. Bitch slapped him. Bam. You know what I'm saying? That is what Obama did. You know what I'm saying? This. I mean, the guy, it should be understood what Obama is, what he represents, and the direct attack and disrespect he has for communities of color throughout the U.S., what disrespect he has for freedom-loving people, not these white nationalist Tea Partiers, to hell with them. I'm talking about freedom-loving people who want true liberation for folks like, the Palestinians, and for them to be able to rid themselves of the boot of Israel that is continually pressing against their neck in places like East Jerusalem and West Bank and Gaza, but this guy continues to bend over just as his predecessors did for Israel. He continues to disrespect the black community in America. And so he has the audacity, Andrea, to go there in front of a whole bunch of black folks. And when he was talking to them, he was talking to black America. Black America couldn't pay for the high-priced tickets to get into that hall. But he was talking to all black America. You know, take off your bedroom slippers. Put on your marching shoes. Shake it off. Stop complaining. Stop grumbling. Stop crying. We are going to press on. We have work to do. Andrea, that is what he said. Yo, that is what this dude said. Stop your grumbling. Stop your complaining. We understand that he did this. We understand he did this a couple of years ago. It says it to black fathers, and he also did it the 100th anniversary of the NAACP. This is what he's about, and you'll have a whole bunch of black folks that unfortunately will make excuses for him. Unfortunately, some of those folks, Andrea, have millions and millions of viewers because they have sold themselves out and sold the interests of black people out just so they can appear on the likes of MSNBC, such as the talented Melissa Harris Perry. Here's Brother Glenn Ford breaking it down, and I'll get your feedback on the other end, Andrea.
Melissa Harris Perry is one of the saddest examples of how the advent of a black president has distorted the thinking of some of the most promising African-American minds. She is a political scientist who has abandoned all the science of politics in order to build a higher black wall around Barack Obama, a war criminal with 6 simultaneous aggressions now running at full tilt and the prime facilitator of the most massive transfer of wealth in human history. Writing from her roost at The Nation magazine, Professor Harris Perry flails about in search of a progressive position from which to defend the first black president. There being none, she has to settle for saying that Obama is as competent as any white president, damn it, and it is white liberals that are bringing Obama down by holding him to a higher standard than his white predecessors, specifically Bill Clinton. Essentially, she contends that Clinton did do bad things to black and poor Americans and to the cause of peace in the world. Obama's record is, she maintains, at the very least comparable to that of President Clinton, who was enthusiastically reelected. We could stop right there and agree with Professor Harris Perry that Bill Clinton and Barack Obama are political peas in a pod, both center-right corporate Democrats at the service of the rich, who are eager to ravage welfare as we know it, or Social Security as we still have it. Both presidents specialize in opening the doors to the Republicans that they pretend to be opposing. And yes, Obama is every bit as competent at playing the corporate game as Bill Clinton ever was. Much better, in fact. Clinton's crew freed Wall Street predators from regulation, while Barack Obama rescued George Bush's bank bailout and then put at least $14 trillion into the accounts of finance capitalists around the world. You can't top that for competence in the service of finance capital. Obama has increased the military budget with utmost competence, surpassing George Bush and putting Bill Clinton to shame in his service to the Pentagon. And when it comes to mounting a frontal assault on the New Deal and the Great Society, nobody can touch Obama, who came into office with a promise on his lips to put all entitlements on the chopping block, and has succeeded in doing so. He is, without question, not just competent, but a most excellent destroyer of social safety nets. Professor Harris Perry's beef is that liberals do not recognize Obama's competence. She says these liberals are to blame for Obama's dramatic fall in white approval ratings. It is true that whites, who gave Obama more of their votes in 2008 than they did Democrat John Kerry in 2004, are threatening to abandon him in 2012. But all the evidence indicates that Obama's white support is evaporating most rapidly among independents, the white swing voters that he caters to so slavishly, not reliably liberal white Democrats. That's why Obama and his crew dismissed liberals, including Harris Perry's left liberal colleagues at The Nation, as having no place else to go, and instead spend all their time wooing the political middle of white America. And that's the same reason black people get nothing but ostentatious contempt from the White House. The problem is not white liberal racism, but that too many white liberals and African Americans will stick with Obama no matter what he says or does, and will make themselves look ridiculous and incompetent in the process. Professor Harris Perry, for example. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
So, Andre, what's your response to that? Especially, you give your perspective, based on, the black perspective is a unique one, because we can't even say, at least this clown, is recently said that immigration reform is important to him. And he's probably going to do a half-assed job at that. But it's a fact. Latinos can't even say that Obama has done to them what he has routinely done to black folks. But so I'll just get your opinion on what do you see with Glenn Ford's analysis, and also the fact that you said that you post heard the Obama's statement at the CBC.
The way he talks to, when he's talking to black Americans, is completely different than when he's talking to white Americans, whether they're Democrat or Republican. The way he phrases things is just like, it's like you're not getting anywhere, and it's your fault. It's like the typical, like, stereotype against black America. Like, you're lazy, and if you really want to do something, then get to work. Like, that's my impression. Like, the way he comes off, that's what he's saying. But when you hear him talk, to the Senate or to the House, which, they're not all white, but it's predominantly white, he's always all about bipartisanship and you know, coming together and reform and working on something that everyone can agree on. And so I just think that, I mean, that's just completely different. That's just a stark difference that, you know, one is like, oh, you know, we'll work things through versus like you're not doing anything because you're not getting anywhere because you don't want to do anything. And yeah, I mean, he might talk about immigration and he might talk about immigration reform and how the Latino community is really important to him, but there's nothing behind that. I mean, that's just talk. That's just like, I'm getting ready for 2012 and this is a growing population and I need their vote, because he's deported, I think, over 1 million undocumented people, more than Bush. So, I mean, he hasn't done anything for the Latino community. So to say that, you know, it's not like that he's making some kind of improvement. I mean, yeah, he talks about it differently. He addresses it. But, I mean, if you're not doing anything at the end of the day, like, what difference does it really make?
Yeah, well, I don't think anyone, I mean, you've never heard that in my mouth. I don't think anyone that's progressive or radical ever said that Obama's doing has done anything for the Latino community. I'm just, but it's not debatable. This guy, at the very least, will say things like, you know, this is what I'm saying is it's not debatable. You know, so the bastard can go ahead and you know, lie all he wants, you know, and he'll do that. He'll lie to the Black community, Latino community, lie to, you know, whoever he wants, to whatever. But here's the point. Even if he were to lie about, for instance, if he were to say such and such about Black unemployment, and he may be lying that he actually gives a damn about it, but him saying that on a national stage, which every time he talks on a national stage, at the very least can lift the specter of consciousness for a whole lot of people that will be listening. So, for instance, like, he went out of his, I mean, he talked about, you know, about Latino unemployment. This was, you know, a good year and a half ago. And then asked by April, I can't remember her last name, asked by the sister who was the reporter in the room, you know, well, you know, look at the unemployment rate of African American. That's higher than Latinos. You know, what do you have to say about that then? And he wouldn't even say that. He went in and went into his archives and quoted Ronald Reagan talking about, you know, if I lift, you know, the waters, you know, the tide, I lift all boats. Well, if some of us are on dinghies and some of us are on yachts, those of us that are on dinghies are in a much more disadvantaged perspective of things. And so, you know, it also plays in the point where Blacks and Latinos need to, you know, really get their heads out of their asses and really start to look at each other as comrades and start to organize together. But, you know, my point, you know, because our similarities are very much in touch, and the whole argument about, you know, so-and-so stealing jobs from you and this, that, and the other, and hearing this, you know, from one community and hearing it from another community is counterintuitive against interest. But my point is that when that press conference occurred, he will say things. So yes, he does not value the Latino community. He wants the votes, just like he wants the Black votes. But what's interesting is, like, yo, he will go as far as like saying, Hey, yeah, you know, there's a real issue with Latino unemployment being 12%. There's a real issue with that. That is very much a real issue, and it needs to be dealt with. But since that's a 12, what do you have to say about you know, the unemployment of Black Americans, which is higher, highest in this country? What do you have to say about that? And he said he wouldn't even touch it. So the backhandedness that this dude has for the Black community, it is beyond reproach, and it is uncomparable to anything, you know. So when Black Americans are going to get frustrated to the point where they actually do something, and they actually go out there and participate in these occupations that Diop was talking about, and not going to the club or to happy hour. You know, some of those folks, you know, are what Malcolm X would classify as good old house Negroes that you know, would like to talk about, you know, fitting in rather than doing things, you know, getting along, you know, going along just to get along, you know. But there's other folks out there that really are in need of politicizing and radicalizing to move beyond the veil and to do something, you know what I'm saying, to organize and to remain consistent about the organization and to see that. And I think it's important for the black community, speaking, you know, as someone from the black community, to for them to see the importance of their own self-worth. Because you see your own self-worth, you understand that this dude, when he makes these kind of comments, as he did a few days ago, and then when he completely ignores your unemployment plight, you know, in comparison to other oppressed groups like Latinos in this country, and ignores yours, you understand that this guy is no friend of yours. He's no friend of yours, and you really need to start seriously looking at alternative political parties, and at the very least starting your own political parties, as we have done. We've seen in 68 and 72, looking at the Black Power Conference and looking at the formation in the 70s of the National Black Political Party. Didn't go very far, but it set the precedent, and being consistent with these organizations. And we have something like that. I mean, we have a Black is Back coalition, which has been around for not too long and has built up, you know, some kind of momentum. You know, these are organizations and movements that need to be supported, you know, because the road to liberation, the road to creating, you know, sustainable political parties and movements, is not easy work. But, you know, freedom from your oppressors, no one ever said it was going to be easy. But you know what, Andre, it's necessary. And so I want to play this and get your feedback, because this is something that we're both going to be participating in soon, and that'll do it for the show. So I want to play this regarding those occupations that Glenn Ford and we were just you know, and others are talking about. Revolution is in the air.
Three occupations of significance are underway or about to begin in the United States. These people's actions share overlapping themes of resistance to the oppression of the many by the few, and attempt to focus the minds of the many on very finite bits of space that represent a larger world that has been alienated from humanity by the greedy grasp of a usurping class. It is hoped that the symbolic liberation of those spaces through physical occupation by the people will set off a chain of human reaction, culminating in a kind of Big Bang that gives birth to a new social universe. Big Bangs have happened before. Human progress depends on them, which is why people spend their entire lives trying to light the fuse. The attempt to occupy ground on Manhattan's Wall Street, the figurative and literal belly of the global financial capitalist beast, has been harassed and increasingly brutalized by police, as must occur if the protest is to crystallize into a narrative of struggle. The Wall Street protesters appear to be, as they describe themselves, a leaderless resistance that is united against the greed and corruption of the 1% of the population that lords it over the rest of us. The protesters were, at least in the beginning, very young, very white, and transparently upscale in social background, just the kind of cohort in need of introduction to the blunt instruments underpinning the rule of the rich. The NYPD soon obliged them. On October 6, a coalition of organizations with many veteran leaders will descend on Freedom Square in Washington, D.C., for an open-ended, nonviolent occupation of federal space. Drawn from social and economic justice, environmental, and peace groups, the activists say they will demand changes that shift power away from concentrated corporate capital and free us to create solutions that lead to a just and sustainable future. in Newark, New Jersey, the People's Organization for Progress, or POP, has launched a different kind of occupation, claiming public space at two busy intersections of the city for daily demonstrations that they plan to continue for 381 days. The duration of the 1955 Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott. POP is, in my estimation, the most effective grassroots, black-based outfit in the country, with hundreds of dues-paying members and many more active associates. The demands of their People's Daily Action for Peace, Jobs, Equality, and Justice are as comprehensive as those of a national organization, as they must be, since the conditions that are inflicted on the people of Newark and every other American inner city have their source in those who rule from Washington in the service of Wall Street, the sites of those other occupations. The activists in Newark are intent on occupying public space in their own city for more than a year or as long as necessary. That is the most profound kind of occupation, a non-stop mobilization of people embedded in their own communities, yet consciously connected to the larger world, a struggle in which there will be no change of venue until all the people's venues are liberated. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Andrea, quickly, what are your thoughts on this this coming occupation of Freedom Plaza and its broader significance that's coming up next Thursday, October 6th?
Yeah. Well, I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's really important to have these manifestations where the elite can see, you know, that people aren't content and aren't just going to stand by and allow these things to happen. And also making it visible to other people who might not be, you know, really engaged in social problems to see that, you know, that there is a problem, something is going on. And I think that for it can be a way to really get a broader support around these issues. And so I think it's important in that sense. However, I do think that a lot of times it becomes this almost like self-serving, I'm going to go to this march or this rally just to make myself feel like I did something. And I don't think that occupations are the same thing as rallies. However, I think that it's important that, you know, we all think about that and that it's not about, you know, today or a couple days or a couple weeks or something, that, you know, these manifestations and occupations are important only if we're doing the work that needs to be done beforehand and after. You know, there are, you know, occupations can be very effective in creating change, but there's a lot of, you know, work that needs to be done on the ground before that to change things legally, as well as after. And something else that kind of stuck out in what Glenn was saying is that I know there was a group from the Rebel Diaz Art Collective that went to Occupy Wall Street, and they had a similar reaction to what he was talking about in terms of it being a very, like, young, white, middle-class, liberal crowd, and their reaction to them, who, you know, their crew is, like, Black and brown people from the Bronx, from the South Bronx. And so, you know, when they rolled in, a lot of these people who were doing, you know, the occupying kind of just looked at them like, who are they and, like, why are they here? And it was just, like, this very ironic and, like, weird, you know, like, situation, because it's, like, you know, now it's starting to hit home for a lot of the middle class, a lot of the white middle class, in terms of, like, the economy, you know, just crumbling. But this is something that has been occurring in Black and brown communities for a long time. And so it's just this, like, very divisive, like, instead of, you know, we're going to build and, like, see, you know, like, this is our struggle. You know, it was weird. And I just think that's, a lot of times, that is what happens. It's very reflective of this, like, group of people who feel like this is their outlet and this is their way of making change, rather than, like, acknowledging that this has been occurring in other communities for centuries.
Right. So what would you like to see come out of this occupation, which I guess this is unique in which, you know, we see it happen in places like
Detroit, it's San Diego, you know, we know the one in Wall Street, and this one in D.C. looks to be the biggest out of all of them so far. And, you know, what I mean by unique is that, it, you know, people are planning on staying there, you know, as long as it, I guess, as long as it takes whatever, you know, it takes means. But, you know, we're talking, you know, successive days and perhaps even beyond that. So, you know, we see the one in Wall Street and people have been occupying for almost a fortnight now. What do you hope to see? What kind of organization or mobilization do you hope to see garnered from that?
I hope to see, you know, people supporting in whatever way they can. I know it's not feasible, especially for a lot of working class people to, you know, to just not go to work and camp out in a plaza. But, you know, just getting involved in whatever way is possible and I know there's going to be a lot of speakers, there's going to be a lot of discussions, there's going to be a lot of people representing different media outlets, different organizations in D.C., and so I hope that people are really building and, you know, finding their commonalities and how they can work together to grow, because there's a lot of little, you know, grassroots organizations and a lot of little independent media outlets like Your World News, but if we can support one another, you know, that's what this is about. It's not about competing. It's about collaborating and you know, having as many outlets as we can to express ourselves, because we should not be limited to, you know, these five mainstream media channels and you know, and your, like, typical mainstream corporations that pass as NGOs to represent the people. And so I hope to see people building across race and class and gender and a number of other issues and really taking this opportunity where we're going to be in a, you know, relatively confined space to talk about how we can work together.
Right, yeah. And what do you think about the significance? We've talked about this off here, but, you know, this is, and I totally agree with you, you know, but I also think that it's important for, you know, these historically oppressed communities, you know, such as Native Americans, you know, Latinos, and obviously certainly, you know, Blacks, mobilizing within their own communities, and also linking up, you know, with organizations like real, you know, progressive, you know, grassroots organizations within each of those, you know, within each of those communities, you know, community by community, city by city, state by state. You know, I just really think that, and this is I'm just putting this out there, I just really think that if there can be a critical mass of mobilization within each of those communities, and then together, because you have to have leaders from those communities that go into those communities, you know, say like yourself going into the Latino community, and really building up the political self-esteem and education within those communities, and then also taking somebody like yourself to also talk about the importance of looking at you know, African-Americans, you know, Black Americans, Africans, as your natural comrades, and the importance of linking up with them. And the same would have to be done in, you know, the Black community as well, linking up with, you know, the importance of linking up with, you know, comrades that are, you know, of the Latino culture. You know what I'm saying? As we know, there are Black Latinos, you know, there are white Latinos. But I'm specifically talking about, you know, Black Latinos and indigenous, you know, Spanish-speaking, you know, so-called Latinos, linking up amongst themselves. So I think that kind of mobilization needs to occur, because in theory, you know, like you and I get it, but, you know, we can't just go into, these communities and just, like, you know, say that there has to be groundwork. There has to be a groundwork mobilization. There has to be a campaign of propaganda that, you know, is about political education, that is, and then also, you know, once that political education and that political self-esteem is built up, then there has to be propaganda that is put out there that has to show black and brown solidarity, its importance, and how, boom, if it happens, we can, have, all these disingenuous so-called politicians tap dancing for us the same way that they love to tap dance for AIPAC every election cycle, as they do stuff in the best interest for a repressive and oppressive death squad known as the State of Israel. What are your thoughts about, I kind of already know them, but for our listeners, what are your thoughts about the importance of black, brown solidarity, but before that, the importance of political education and political self-esteem within the Latino community, first and foremost?
Well, nobody knows a community's issues more than the people from that community, right? And so I think that's what you're getting. I think that it's essential that each community, builds within themselves, organizes within themselves, identifies what the issues in their communities are, and once that is established, and of course, the education piece is critical, because if you don't know the history of, for example, in the Latino community of whatever country you come from, and why there's so many Latinos here, and why we are from so many different countries, and we represent a variety of cultures, we speak different dialects of Spanish, but somehow we're all lumped together as Latinos. What does that mean? What is that?
Right.
What do we symbolize here, and what does that mean to us now? And so, yes, now we are no longer in our separate countries, and we have to recognize that our issues, the issues that brought us here, largely still exist, but those issues are very commonly unknown. The economic destabilization of Latin America, the U.S. occupation of many Latin American countries, that type of thing, that needs to be understood for us to understand how we need to continue to fight with our brothers and sisters in Latin America, and what stance we should take towards the U.S. government while we are in this country, and how we are treated in this country. And if we don't understand that history, if we are not educated on that history, kind of like what Zane was saying, he didn't really understand his African roots until he read people like Dr. King and Malcolm X and Marcus Garvey. If we don't, in each of our communities, if we don't read about those leaders, then we're not going to understand our history, and we're not going to know where we need to go from here. And so I think first and foremost, there needs to be a lot of education, and with education comes a deeper understanding of our individual identities and where we need to go from there. And once that's established, then looking to other communities that have been historically oppressed to see the similarities, the common denominator, and how we can build on a lot, because a lot of issues affect multiple communities, maybe to varying degrees, but nonetheless, they're still affected. And so recognizing that is essential, and understand, and talking about, I think when you have those, I guess you would say cross-cultural meetings, talking about those stereotypes that each group has against the other, because it's kind of like having the elephant in the room and not talking about it and just pretending that it doesn't exist. Like, everybody knows it exists. So, like, it needs to be, you can't bring closure and understanding to a certain issue unless it's discussed. And so talking about the stereotypes that each community has against the other, which are so destructive and divisive and have been created so that it does just that, keeps us separated so that we can't organize together, I think, to me, that's the second step. And then, once you have that, then, continue to have each group's identity and understand that we have certain things that are unique to each of our communities, but we also have a lot more things that are that we have in common to each other. And and based on those things, continue to collaborate, continue to build, and realize that we are not so-called minorities, that we are not numerically minimal, especially if we come together. And if we could realize that, and we could, each person, how the Black Panthers used to say, each one teach one, if we could all do that and make it, our goal to teach as many people as we can, then about our history and about building solidarity across communities, I think we could make a lot of change and really demand that politicians, you know, respect and see to our demands, not just come around and say whatever they say so that they can get our vote, and then we don't really care, you know, to, like, hold them accountable for the promises that they made.
Especially looking at the I definitely with the similar, you know, being someone that grew up with a lot of you know, Afro Dominicans and Afro Puerto Ricans, you know, I certainly know that these folks are like Spanish speaking Africans, and you know, the whole Latino thing as Hispanic is in a lot of ways a misnomer. And so, you know, the similarities between, you know, Afro-Latinos, you know, and African-Americans is very, very deep. You know, and that's, you know, first and foremost, beyond even looking at, indigenous Latinos, you know, which has strong similarities, you know, as well. You know, looking at the, for instance, the impact and the work that, for instance, the Black Panther Party impact that organization had, you know, on AIM and the Young Lords, and the work that these organizations did with each other, and how they you know, found a lot of not just solidarity but momentum within the work with each other. But I've always had but for a long time I've had a real issue with that term. I mean, Latino is such a misnomer, especially looking in the case of indigenous folks who are direct descendants, completely direct descendants from indigenous people. And the only reason they speak Spanish is because the colonizer was Spanish, and in the same way that I speak English because the colonizer of my ancestors was English. You know, that's an important route of that history that needs to be, you know what I'm saying, needs to be unveiled, as Zane indicated. That's a very, very important aspect of history that needs to be unveiled for folks to really, like, take a step back. Like, damn, I never even thought about that way. Damn. 'Cause I remember, you know, some of my friends that are Dominican, you know, when one of our Dominican friends, like, he said, I'm a Spanish speaking African. I mean, that like took them aback, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, but they were like open minded enough, like, yo, you know what? That's right. You know, we are Spanish speaking Africans. You know what I'm saying? We are, our ancestors were direct Africans. So it's got to be in stages. So, you know, folks that are listening, you know, I'm sure a lot of folks that are listening are doing that kind of work right now. You know, the work, you know, it's hard, you know, it's just telling somebody that to stay. You can't expect somebody to respect themselves. I mean, to respect, respect themselves if they're, you know, just automatically respecting other people more than they do themselves, you know, and such is that with the educational system in this country, where you have brown and black skinned kids, you know, respecting, you know, slave owners like George Washington and respecting the history of other people without respecting themselves first. Like, your history and the history of movements and specific communities, as you said, you know, communities know what they need best. They may not necessarily know how to whatever, because unfortunately a lot of our communities, black and Latino, you know, and this is important. This is important because you brought up a good point, Andrea. But the point is that, yes, they know what they whatever. But unfortunately, we have allowed ourselves. All right. So we may know what we need best, but in terms of we do not know completely. We are not there yet in terms of politicizing ourselves in our best interests. So it's almost like we don't know what we need best sometimes, because if that was the case, you wouldn't have Latinos continually either voting for Republicans or Democrats like they do. you wouldn't have black folks just being completely obsequious to the Democratic Party, you know, like a lover who's just continually cheats on them. That's what the Democratic Party has done for black Americans for a long, long time. And Malcolm, you know, may he rest in peace, you know, pointing this out, you know, 40-plus years ago. You know, these are still the Dixiecrats. Come on. And he wasn't talking about turning to Republicans as an alternative, but this is who they are, you know. So that education has to come, and we have to also be educating this, which leads me to my last question to you, Andre, you know, putting you on the spot, is that we also have to really start to put pressure on organizations that are supposed to be advocating on our behalf, put pressure on them to, like, listen, you know, and just be calling them out for what they are, that in the hopes that, you know, other people will listen and other people will start to call them out and we'll see what you're talking about, what I'm talking about, and more and more voices will come out, and then, you know, radicalize these organizations that are supposed to be advocating on our behalf. And my question to you, Andrea, is, you know my stance on, we discussed before, you know, the NAACP and how they have turned into a corporate, an organization, you know, different chapters. You know, there's some chapters that are progressive, but in terms of the national leadership, I mean, when you have the likes of Ben Jealous cozying up to Obama, and that, you know, you're seeing that relationship rear its ineffective head within the organization and the work that it should be doing in the black community. I ask you, Andre, what is your take on La Raza, National Council of La Raza? Have they been effective? If they haven't, what do you see their shortcomings are, and why are their shortcomings so?
I mean, to be honest, I don't follow a tremendous amount of what National Council of La Raza does. What I do know is that they're funded by a number of corporations that historically do not have the best interests in our communities, and a lot of their stances have been, at best mediocre in terms of, really putting pressure on President Obama on issues of immigration reform and creating venues for people to become documented, or giving opportunities to people who have shown that they are, good citizens to be able to attain citizenship. I can't speak about a lot of things, but just generally I know that they have been very middle of the road, and they have not taken a hard stance on a lot of the issues that affect the Latino community.
What's your position on the DREAM Act? Do you have any issues with the DREAM Act? Is there anything, within the DREAM Act it's important to know. I think it's important for us to know that the work what these organizations are doing. I mean, I don't necessarily follow the NAACP, but I know what they're doing, and I know their movements, and I think we need to know the movements of these folks and these individuals in order to critique them and to call them out and to pressure them to do what, you know, what they're not. Or in some cases, some of these folks are not going to, they're not going to, they've picked their sides. They have picked their sides, and they're not going to rock their boat or their corporate interests, if you will, any shape, form, or fashion, but damn it, I'll be damned if I'm gonna we're gonna let some of those folks in these organizations off the hook and to have our silent approval, and I think that we do that with Your World News. My second part of my last question to you is what I just asked, the DREAM Act. I mean, it's going to be, obviously, be revisited. We see that in different states it's had some or less traction. Is there anything specific within the DREAM Act that you you know, I ask you this. It's kind of a question because it's based on a piece that you wrote some time ago about the Dream Act that was, I thought, was right on point, that, you know, may have ruffled the feathers of some folks within your community. Like, why is she, like, you know, speaking on the out on the Dream Act on this? What do you see? Can you tell us what you found, you know, and what you find particularly, I don't know, uneasy, destructive within the details of the Dream Act?
So, to me, the Dream Act symbolizes one of those really sick games that politicians like to play, where they take I don't know, weakness, or not even a weakness, but a point of a lot of contention and pain and suffering within a community, and try to use that to draw people into it. Meanwhile, they really have this secret agenda to, and in this case, it's not so secret, but I mean, like, you know, there's a second or alternative agenda that they have, where they're not really concerned with providing citizenship to undocumented people, but they have a goal of utilizing this problem and turning it into a way that they can profit, or a way to take advantage of this problem within this community. And so, to me, with the Dream Act, as we know, you have the opportunity, if you graduated from a school within your state and you're in good standing, you don't have a criminal record, and your parents have paid taxes, I believe it's the last year of high school, or it might have been all throughout high school. If you can prove all those things, then you can either, you know, start your citizenship process by going into college, or by going into serving in the military, and then supposedly at the end, you know, you'll have citizenship. Truthfully, there's nothing that guarantees that you'll get citizenship. There have been a lot of people who have gone within both venues and have not received citizenship. Also, with the military provision, there is nothing, there's no two-year contract in the military. You have to serve at least 8 years. The more concerning part of the Dream Act is obviously the military provision. Within the Latino community, there isn't the economic support for us to attend college. Even if our grades are there, we can't, you know, if you're undocumented, you can't apply for FAFSA. You can't apply for the majority of scholarships. So, you know, that's going to push a lot of Latinos to, you know, decide to serve in the military in order to, you know, reach this this dream of having citizenship. And so the way I see it is it's a ethnic draft, just how there's, you know, there's always been a poverty draft, where overwhelmingly the people in, you know, in the front lines in any war are poor working class people. This is, to me, a very, you know, it's something first of all, it was created by the Pentagon. You know, the Pentagon drafted the Dream Act. So that alone is going to tell you the direction and what the reasons behind it really are. So I think that if people in my community could start to see it for what it is, and not allow, not allow ourselves to be compromised. This is one of those issues where you have to take a side, because, like you said, on some things it's about life or death, and this is about life or death. Like, because what it comes down to is a lot of these students, or a lot of these young people who are going to choose to go into the military and go on off into these wars of, you know, supporting U.S. imperialism, killing other brown people around the world, are going to die, because most of the time they're not put in positions where they're going to be officers and they're going to be able to, you know, be sergeants and this and that. No, like, they're soldiers. They're the frontline soldiers that are going to get killed. And so, and we already have, you know, with previous wars, we already have evidence that that's true. And so it is about life or death, and what do you stand for, and how does that, you know, this kind of goes back to what we were saying in terms of, like, how do you identify and how much of your history are you aware of, that, you know, like, you are supporting basically the same ideas that were pushed upon your own country and the same invasions that occurred in your own country that brought you and your family here. And so I think that that's where that education needs to come in. A lot of young Latinos do not have that perspective or don't have that historical context to understand why, first and foremost, they, you know, shouldn't want to serve in the U.S. military. And second, why, you know, this bill is really just like a sham to get us, you know, get us where it hurts and then really put us in a compromising situation where we could lose a lot of our community for wars that have nothing to do with us and to kill innocent people in other countries. And so it's very unfortunate because I have seen how young Latinos through the, you know, what they call themselves, the Dream Activists, have organized and mobilized, and they have done an incredible job organizing. However, I think that they're organizing in the wrong direction. I think that if, as many of them as they are, if they took the stance that they will not, you know, that they do not support the Dream Act so long as it has a military provision, and that they will, those Latinos who are citizens like myself will not vote for, you know, political candidates who support the Dream Act until they change it and take out the military provision, we could really do something big. We could really demand that politicians make that change, or those of us that can vote aren't going to vote for them, you know, because just as many, you know, there's a lot of undocumented young people, but there's also a lot of documented young people who do have the power to vote on the behalf of those in our community who are undocumented and demand that, you know, this provision be changed. But unfortunately, when you bring that up, a lot of times it's very contentious because people don't understand that historical context, and you know, they haven't been taught that in school for obvious reasons, and a lot of people who are first generation haven't really had those conversations with their parents because it might be something difficult for their parents to talk about, you know, what they went through, and it's a discussion that needs to be started.
Right on. That's a good way to end the show. And so, in essence, you are, whether you agree or not, you're basically, stating the reason why, because you said that education has to be, whether it's, you know, difficult or not, that education has to be had. And so, as we know, political expression, well, maybe not all of us know, but political expression does not start and end with the ballot box. You know, there's a whole lot of stuff that has to occur on the ground level, education, political education. So pieces like yours, the piece that you did, people can go to yourworldnews.org, click on blogs, and just, click on one of the tabs, or just, and you'll find it. You'll find Andrea's piece on the Dream Act. It's there. You know, you can click on Latin America, and it will undoubtedly, you know, come up. So it's there, you know. So we ask that, you know, take some time to read it, but your piece and pieces like yours are extremely important, you know, because even if it brings about the awareness of a small number of people, at the same time turning off a larger number of people, you know, you got to rock with that base. We got to rock with that small number of people and see them as that beginning of that critical mass that can, as you said, you know, importantly mobilize and reshape this Dream Act to be something that is not sending, you know, poor, disenfranchised, you know, Latinos overseas to kill some brown folks that that look very much like them. You know what I'm saying? It's a very, very sick thing. Very sick thing,
right.
Which is
And I'll say this last thing. There are, you know, just like around any issue in any community, there are people who have spoken out, and Educators de la Raza, which is not part of National Council de la Raza. They're different. They're a group, an organization of predominantly Chicano educators in the West Coast, they have taken the stance as an organization to oppose the DREAM Act as long as it has the military provision, because they understand the underlying intentions of the Pentagon and what it will lead in our community because of our economic situation. So I think that it's important to recognize that, you know, there are people who are speaking out, and I mean, unfortunately, like you did mention, a lot of people in the Latino community are have been upset with this response. I know that when I've gone into conversations, people have gotten very bothered by my stance because they feel like I'm being ungrateful or I'm being anti-American. But I think that more than anything, it doesn't really offend me. I think that what it speaks to is a lack of identity and a lack of understanding of our history. So I think that that just shows where we have a lot of work to do.
Well, and that goes my point. And, you know, so I'll get the last one. My point is also playing off what you said. Of course, we say it. How many times do we say that there's people out there doing similar work? But if we're not going to write about it, if we're not going to talk about it, those folks that are tuning in, and we know the masses in this country are not getting the critical information that they need. The masses in this country are not learning about the grassroots work that a lot of brothers and sisters are doing right now. But they'll hear all about the Sharptons and the Jesse Jacksons and the Ben Jellises and the Mark Morials, and you could just go on and on and on. So it's vastly important for people like you, I'm saying, to continue to write pieces that are about the DREAM Act, and within those pieces having links and some kind of direction, as you had before, to those other individuals, those organizations, that people, I mean, that's the best kind of article that one can read, especially online, one that has hyperlinks to those things, you know, show me the way. All right, you're telling me this is that, the other. Well, show me those individuals so I can get that more information. And so, you know, I'm in a roundabout way, putting a little pressure. I'm waiting for that next piece. I know you're working on a follow up piece to that first piece that you did, and your voice and your perspective as a Latina in America is vastly needed, and your insight and your knowledge about other people that are doing similar work is vastly needed. And so when we don't expose the work that other folks are doing that you know the masses need to have, we become in essence of a part of that problem. So you know, but because the way it's built is a system built to make us feel like we are isolated, or that Andrea, or that Solomon, or that Your World News is the only organization out there. Your World News is not the only organization that is putting this information out, and that's why we continue each time to tell you, you know, go to Yahoo News, go to Black Agenda Report, go to Your World News, and we have a long laundry list of links to other, you know, news outlets and organizations. And if there's something that we should be posting up there, please, by all means, email us. You know, our emails are on the website. Let us know. So anyways, thanks to Diop, thanks to Zane and Maurice. And thanks to all of you for listening and making this show a success. We're just trying to provide some space and opportunity for the information to get out there that is desperately people are trying to bury. So until next time, on behalf of Andrea and everyone else associated with Your World News, we'll see you next time. And I think that we're building towards a really important show in the near future. We're working right now. I'll just let it be known that we're working on trying to get an interview with some exonerated death row survivors, which their voices and their experiences really need to be out there. So thank you all, and as they say, peace and unrest.